Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, we'll have an interview with Gloria Feltz about electing more female leaders. Also, a review of John McCain's campaign strategies, a smackdown of CNN for running with a scare story, and another anti-choice song clip. I promise that this will be the only mention, ever, of the bloggers on Jezebel making fools of themselves on Liz Winstead's show Thinking and Drinking. I was sympathetic to them on my blog because they were trying to joke about stuff, and I know the pain of a joke falling flat. But they pushed a bit of misinformation that needs serious correction.
Withdrawal has always worked for me.
100%. I know that's irresponsible to say, but it's the most fun way to not get pregnant.
I know, you just slurred it everywhere.
It is neither true that pulling out is a decent method of not getting pregnant, nor that it's objectively the most fun method. Someone is getting pregnant pulling out somewhere in the world as you listen to this, it works so badly. And they're staining the sheets while they're doing it for some total loss. Dramatically flinging the used condom in the trash can, perhaps to music, is a way to satisfy the need for entertainment, and it's safer to boot. It increasingly seems like John McCain's strategy for dealing with the landmine of reproductive issues is to punt the questions. Campaign watchers started to deduce this when McCain pleaded ignorance on the subject of condom usage to prevent HIV. Some video bloggers covered the issue at the forethought.
In an interview while on the campaign trail in 2007, Senator John McCain was asked an extremely important question, one that we believe any American middle schooler should be able to answer at this point. And that was, do you feel that contraceptives, meaning condoms, help to stop the spread of HIV? Now, Senator McCain's answer is extremely troubling. It was, quote, you've stumped me.
But what seemed to be a mere stumble is beginning to look like a bona fide strategy of avoiding the question. Just listen to this clip from MSNBC.
He was asked by a Pool reporter about a statement made by Carly Fiorina of his campaign that it's unfair that insurance companies cover Viagra, but not birth control. Here's that awkward exchange.
Insurance companies cover Viagra and not birth control, and
I certainly do not want to discuss that issue.
It was unfair that health insurance companies cover Viagra but not birth control. Do you have an opinion on that?
I don't know enough about it to give you a informed answer.
We clocked that pause at 8 seconds back in our control room. He says, I'll have to get back to you on that. I'd rather not talk about that right now.
Why is this issue so hard? No, really. More than half of voters are women, and 98% of them have used contraception at some point in their life. Really, when 98% of more than half of the voting population actively enjoys a certain right, and the other half of the electorate is supportive of that enjoyment, then what's the issue? You'd think contraception would be as popular as spring days and ice cream. Well, it's because he doesn't think he can win without the religious right, who are clearly a hardline minority vote, but still wildly influential. With McCain leaning hard to the right on the religious right's favorite issues, it's hard to imagine why he's still on notice with them. He's crossed his T's and dotted his I's on abortion, gay marriage, and as we see here, he's willing to play that he's amenable to restrictions on contraception. And yet they still have a grudge. It goes back to the primary of 2000.
Senator McCain, I want to ask you, in a sense, the flip side, the mirror image of Jeff's question to Governor Bush. Earlier this week, you called Pat Robertson and other leaders of the Christian conservative movement agents of intolerance. A little later, you even called them evil, although you explained that was a joke. Mm-hmm. But you do sound as if you've kind of declared war on a large portion of your own party. And it's a portion whose supporters make up a large part of the electorate, including here in California. So what I want to ask you is, can you win the general election in November without the votes of Christian conservatives? If you win the nomination, aren't they likely to simply stay home or perhaps even vote for Patrick Buchanan?
Yeah, that's haunted him since. Since he lost in 2000, I'm guessing he thinks that was a major misstep and he's not making that mistake again. Though he already won the primary, and the hard right vote is diluted in the general election. He really backtracked a couple of years ago on Meet the Press.
Do you think that Jerry Falwell's ideas are now good for the Republican Party?
I believe that the Christian right has a major role to play in the Republican Party. One reason is because they're so active in their, and their followers are. And I believe they have a right to be a part of our party. I don't have to agree with everything they stand for, nor do I have to agree with everything that's on the liberal side of the Republican Party. If we have to agree on every issue, we're not a Republican Party. I believe in open and honest debate. Was I unhappy in the year 2000 that I lost the primary and there were some attacks on me that I thought was unfair? Of course. Should I get over it? Can I serve the people of Arizona best by looking back in anger or moving forward?
Do you believe that Jerry Falwell is still an agent of intolerance?
No, I don't. I think that Jerry Falwell can explain to you his views on this program when you have him on.
Of course, Falwell was an agent of intolerance, and that's why the hard right-wingers followed him. If he wasn't an agent of intolerance, he'd have died a nobody in Virginia. His entire life was dedicated to being an agent of intolerance. But I see why McCain realizes that the accurate phrase might set off believers who prefer their agency of intolerance to get a more cuddly name. But some believers are going to hold his accurate comments of 2000 against him until forever, so he's been running hard to the right on their issues to try to win them back. I suggest campaign reporters make a sport of asking McCain about various forms of contraception and availability to see if you can get him to set a record for the length and silence of his pauses before he refuses to answer the question. I'd like to welcome Gloria Felt to the program. Gloria was the president of Planned Parenthood until 2005 and is now a leading feminist speaker and activist. She's got an article in an upcoming issue of Elle magazine about the obstacles to electing more female leadership. She's here today to talk specifically about that article and its implications. Welcome to RealityCast, Gloria.
I am delighted to be here, Amanda. Thank you.
So what are the major obstacles to getting women elected into more public offices?
There's the conventional wisdom, and there is some different, wisdom that I gleaned while I was exploring why women do and don't run for office. Not all of it was terribly heartening, I must tell you. What I found was that, in truth, although the prevailing wisdom is that women have a harder time fundraising and women have a harder time getting credibility and getting people to vote for them once they run for office, the empirical data is that women actually are as able to fundraise as men once they put themselves out there. And although they may not have as big a corporate Rolodex, they're very good at fundraising. They're very good at asking for the money and getting it. And that when women are running, in fact, voters today trust women in politics more than they trust men. So this should be a wonderful time for women. And you really can't even talk about this without talking about the woman who almost became the Democratic nominee for president. Hillary Clinton has certainly shown that women can be smart enough, tough enough, ambitious enough, and have every other quality that's necessary to successfully run for office. So then we have to ask ourselves, well, why is it that women make up only 16% of Congress? And only, 8 out of 50 governors? Why is it that in state legislatures, women are still less than 25%? Well, I spoke with quite a number of women who are in elective office, and I think Janet Napolitano, the governor of Arizona, summed it up very well when she said, you can't win if you don't run.
Do you think that Clinton's run will encourage more women to see themselves as somebody who can run?
I think so. I hope so. I know that some people feel that Clinton's run will make younger women particularly feel that it would be just a very difficult thing, that they saw how she got beaten up, they saw the sexist media coverage, they saw how she was judged much more harshly from a gender perspective than her male running adversaries. But overall, I think the most important message that young women and all women got from Hillary Clinton's run is that never again will any girl grow up thinking she can't be president. And that's just that's an amazing watershed moment in history for women running for office. But it'll be up to the women to take that opportunity. And that's really what my research found, is that by and large, the doors are opening if they're not already open. But you know what? We got to walk through them. We got to put ourselves out there, and we got to do it in large enough numbers, because very few people win their first run for office. So that means that a lot of people have to run, and then sometimes you have to run over and over before you're finally elected.
So what do you think causes women to feel they can't run more than men?
I think a big part of it has just been the lack of role models. If you look at the history of women running for office, what you find is that there have been three waves of women running for office. The first wave was women who basically were tabbed to run for office when their husbands died. So like Margaret Chase Smith in Maine in the 1940s, her husband was a senator, he died, they asked her to run. She won office. She wouldn't have thought of running for office on her own. But once she was elected, she ran again, and she won handily. The second wave of women who ran for office were women like Nancy Pelosi, who were politically engaged for, you know, for many, many years. Very often, they were the envelope stuffers in men's campaigns. They did the, you know, they did the administrative work. They knocked on the doors. They were the legs that the campaigns walked on. The campaigns couldn't have gone on without these women. But they, again, didn't think about running themselves. They were helping the male candidates. Well, then, when their children grew up and left home, these women very often decided, well, why not me? But they were already in their, say, 50s, some of them in their 60s. And so there was a wave of women who ran at that stage of life, and that's great. But one of the things about politics is that you have to stay there in order to get the seniority that you need to really have power, to have the power to set an agenda. So in other words, to become the next Ted Kennedy, you have to start when you're young. You have to be there a long time in the Senate in order to chair committees and really get the power that lets you set the agenda. Just recently, and honestly, when I went for Nancy Pelosi's swearing in last year in January of 2007, it was the first time that I saw around me, my goodness, there are enough young women who are in Congress now that they can stay here long enough that they can become the committee chairs. They can become the Ted Kennedys. They can become the Harry Reids. They can become the ones who wield the agenda-setting power. And I think that will change everything. And that will also give other women more of a role model to follow.
Your article doesn't address this in depth, but you can here. Would electing more female leadership impact the reproductive rights debate, and how?
Well, I don't think there's any question about what it would affect the reproductive rights debate. Now, that said, let me be clear, not every woman is pro-choice, and not every pro-choice person is a woman. So the great thing about the pro-choice constituency, as well as those who are elected to office, is that it's a very broad base. You have Democrats, Republicans, you have men, you have women, you have people of all economic stripes and all ethnicities. So that's great. It's a very broad base. But that's also kind of a weakness, because it means that it's very difficult to just mass your strength. You're always having to work across all of those different lines and to hold a very big coalition that's very diverse together. And sometimes the reason that's hard is because they may be pro-choice, but that may not be their top issue. So they will give up on their pro-choice vote in order to get something else that they want even more. That's politics, after all. The art of the possible, as they say. But that having been said, I mean, one experience that I will never forget was on, in fact, I believe it was Women's Equality Day in maybe 1998. And I flipped on CNN, and we had been working on getting contraceptive coverage passed. Well, we hadn't been totally successful in getting contraceptive coverage passed, but we were successful in getting an amendment placed on an appropriations bill that gave contraceptive coverage to federal employees in their insurance plan. And as you know, the federal employees insurance plan is the largest plan in the country, and therefore it's often a model that other insurance plans follow. So the women across party lines had gotten together, and the picture I will never forget on C-SPAN was of all of these women, brightly colored dresses, and it looked like a sea of skirts on the Capitol steps. Democrats and Republicans, almost every woman in the Congress was standing together with their colleagues in support of contraceptive coverage. Now, you don't find that kind of unanimity around every reproductive justice issue, but I think that on many of the issues like contraceptive coverage, you would find that having more women would make a huge difference because they understand what an injustice it is for an insurance plan to cover every single medication a man needs, often including Viagra, for example, but not covering women's basic health care, which is contraception. So they just get it. They just get it.
Do you have ideas on how we could move towards electing more female politicians beyond what we're doing right now?
That's a really great question. And I've thought about it, and I've asked many of the people who are involved in organizations like the White House Project and the Women's Campaign Fund and the Wish List, who are trying to get more women to run for office. And there are a couple of answers. One is that some of these programs try to get women involved in the political process in some way without necessarily making that running for office a requirement. And that gets more women engaged and knowledgeable, and then after a while, more women hopefully would decide, well, I want to be the one actually making the decisions. I want to be the one on that school board or city council or state legislature or Congress. I want to be the one pulling the levers, yes or no, on this legislation. That would be almost inevitable. So I think engaging more women in a systematic way in political activity, whether or not it's running for office, would ultimately lead to more women running for office. But I also think that it starts very, very young. I'd like to see girls in junior high and high school as part of their civics lessons or just as part of their sort of general social skills learning to learn more about how to engage controversy, how not to be frightened or put off by the fact that somebody argues with you or maybe doesn't like you. That's okay. Men don't care about that. Men will just get back up and keep going. And so I think that's a skill that women need to learn. And I can tell you from personal experience that it is something that you can learn. When I was first working with Planned Parenthood 30 some odd years ago, I was kind of timid myself. And when people would challenge me in public, I would maybe back off a little bit. But what I learned was that I wasn't struck dead if somebody didn't like me. I wasn't struck dead if somebody argued with me. And that in fact, by putting my issues and my beliefs out there, it was doing a public service. That's what citizenship is about. So it's positive citizenship skills I think we need to start teaching young girls and women from the get-go.
Look out for the article See Jane Run in the August issue of Elle. Our writer is Gloria Felt. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Gloria.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks, Amanda.
Now listen up.
The crankery about the HPV vaccine makes me doubly insane, because it plays on two of my biggest hot buttons, which are mindless sex phobias and the anti-vaccination crankery. I will never understand why vaccinations, of all things, have become this focal point for people who are willing to say or do anything to attack them. It's not just the HPV vaccination, but all childhood vaccinations that have set off waves of ridiculous claims about how they cause autism, which they most definitely do not. Why do cranks have it out for vaccinations? There just seems to be something about preventive medicine that brings out the worst crankery. It's like the fluoridation of the last century. People just want to believe that someone is out to get them when someone is actually trying to help them. Of course, you can't suddenly develop autism at 14 years old, so that bit of misinformation won't get attached to the HPV vaccination. But don't think that this will mean that people won't try to spread paranoia. We are talking about the deadly combination of preventive medicine and sexual health care, which is going to drag out the paranoias. CNN should be ashamed of themselves for adding fuel to the fire by having a report that made it seem like the HPV vaccination is especially dangerous.
She says that her daughter, Jessalie, was a perfectly healthy 13-year-old girl when she got the Gardasil shot and within hours started feeling sick, developed pancreatitis, which is can be a very dangerous illness, had to have two surgeries, spent weeks and weeks in the hospital, and now, more than a year later, is still sick and often missing school. She is the first person to file a case in federal court about Gardasil. A second one followed shortly thereafter.
If you've got an eye for these things, then you can already see where this report is misleading. Yes, I'm sure this woman thinks that the sequence of events means that it's a causal relationship, but that's not necessarily so. But more importantly, you can guess that if this is in fact crankery, then the vaccine will be accused of causing a whole host of diseases with the symptoms unique to each sufferer. Why is this a problem? Because most diseases tend to have a cluster of symptoms in common, not just any old thing under the sun. The fact that the second case isn't spelled out inclines me to think it's an entirely separate disease, which means that people are likely blaming coincidences on the shot. But then CNN really steps over the line.
As of April, there have been nearly 8,000 complaints, adverse event filings, to the FDA, people saying they got sick from Gardasil.
Oh yeah? Sick with what? Gosh, wanna bet the shot is getting blamed for everything from having an itchy arm to getting the flu to stubbing your toe? That adverse reactions are reported doesn't mean they're real. The accompanying article says that of these nearly 8,000 complaints, 15 were deaths, and already the CDC has affirmed that 10 of the deaths have no relationship to the shot, and I'm sure that all or most of the other 5 will be cleared. The CNN reporter does admit that the immediate explanation is coincidence. But by putting these words in the mouths of the company that makes the drug, and not noting that Merck is being backed by independent government agencies, she's leaving a question mark where none belongs. And when the reporters ask what parents can do, she has this answer.
Talk to your pediatrician. You don't have to give your daughter this shot. You can only get this disease if you're having sex. And some parents are saying, my 11-year-old daughter's not having sex. She doesn't need this shot.
So irresponsible. By saying, oh, you don't have to worry until your kids have sex, she's encouraging people to put their kids at risk. You get the shot before you have sex, which is why the 11-year-olds. That's how vaccines work. Before the exposure. Not, I rubbed my face in polio, then I got the shot. Before exposure. Before. By putting it that way, you're encouraging people to see this shot as judgment on their parenting skills, when they need to see it as routine care. The last thing we need is parents thinking that getting this shot for their daughters is as good as admitting that they failed some kind of stop your kids from humping test. Not to get ranty, but it just makes me so mad. This country is paranoid about sex to the degree that we'd rather see girls die unnecessarily of cervical cancer than chill out about the reality of sex. Thanks to Feminese for the link and the analysis. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. I asked for people to send me anti-choice songs, and one reader named Joanna did. Thanks, Joanna, for this clip of Mommy, Can You Hear Me by Caroline Purr.
Mommy, can you feel me? Feel me growing inside you. Mama,
that one is part of the singing fetus genre, where the fetus itself sings and berates its mother. That is the first song I've heard where the singing fetus is a woman. The singer is peddling mediocre adult contemporary crap, so I find myself unmoved by the argument that the world absolutely needs her talents.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.